I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. If you thought this was an unusually hot summer, you're right. The Washington Post reported that there were record temperatures on every continent north of the equator, while the lower 48 had the hottest stretch of weather from late spring to early summer. In other parts of the world, residents in an Algerian city had to contend with the highest temperatures ever recorded in Africa. NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reported that hot nights helped to push up those summer temperatures. Well, we asked Jennifer Francis to join us to explain what is going on. She's a research professor at Rutgers University's Department of Marine and Coastal Science. Jennifer Francis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So are we going to have to get used to these hot summers?
Yes, we will. This is one of the clearest signals of global warming as a result of all the extra carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that we've been dumping into the atmosphere for the last several decades. And this is, we expect these warmer temperatures to just increase. And some of these extremes that we've been seeing around the Northern Hemisphere in particular are not just due to the overall warming, but also shifts in the way the wind patterns work in the upper atmosphere, a feature that we know as the jet stream.
Let me pick up on a couple of things. You talked about the Northern Hemisphere. Was it or has it been hotter in the Northern Hemisphere than the Southern based on what we can typically expect?
Yes, and the reason that the Northern Hemisphere is affected more obviously is that because we have a lot more land in the Northern Hemisphere than there is in the Southern Hemisphere. But the ocean absorbs probably about 90% of that extra heat that's trapped by greenhouse gases. And so it takes a lot of energy to warm up the ocean and less energy to warm up the land. And so we're seeing these extremes happen more often in the summer over the continents in the Northern Hemisphere.
In fact, I was reading, I think it was Finland, which I guess sticks into the Arctic. One day it was 90 degrees?
Yes, Scandinavia had an incredibly warm summer. And they're not used to that sort of thing. They don't have air conditioning there. And it led to also a very dry conditions, and they saw a lot of forest fires in that part of the world. So it was a crazy summer for them as well.
Explain what's happening with the jet stream.
Well, it's not a simple story, but the basic idea is that as we're warming the Arctic much faster than anywhere else, and that's because of the loss of ice and snow that's been happening up there. When we lose that ice and snow, it leaves behind a much darker surface, and so that darker surface can absorb much more of the sun's energy. So that's the sort of simple reason why we're seeing the Arctic warm so much faster. And the difference in temperature between the Arctic, which is normally much colder than it is farther south, that north-south temperature difference is really what drives the winds of the jet stream. Hmm. So as we warm the Arctic so much faster, it's making that temperature difference smaller, and so there's basically less fuel to drive the jet stream. And when the jet stream gets weaker, it's more easily deflected north and south from its usual path, and so we're seeing it take these big swings northward and then big dips southward more so than it used to. And those big dips tend to basically get stuck in place for a long time. And what happened over Scandinavia, for example, was one of these big northward swings just kind of got stuck in place right there and allowed a lot of extra warm air to travel much farther north. And also it led to conditions in the atmosphere that steered storms away from them. And so this kind of thing is not an isolated event in one location, but instead we see these kind of big north-south swings happen all around the Northern Hemisphere, leading to the various extremes that you listed.
Is there any evidence that this is just a temporary blip? We know that there are fluctuations when it comes to things like weather. We've got stormy and sometimes less stormy times during the year. Could this be an aberration, or is this a trend that really defines our future?
Well, we believe that this tendency to see these big north-south swings in the jet stream will continue and will probably get even more in more obvious, but they don't set up in the same place every year. So while Scandinavia happened to be under one of these big northward swings this year, next year it could be in a different situation and perhaps even have a cold, rainy summer. So it really depends on where these big swings north and south are located relative to your location as to what kind of weather you might get stuck with. So sort of the bottom line of all this is that we expect that the rapidly warming Arctic is going to lead to weather patterns of all sorts becoming more persistent.
That's Jennifer Francis, the first of three guests on Radio Times today. She's research professor at Rutgers University's Department of Marine and Coastal Science. We called her up because we wanted to understand what's happening with the weather, what it reveals about the climate. And again, you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Jennifer, I read, and this came from NOAA, that the nights are not necessarily cooling off the way they used to. How significant is that?
This is a huge thing that's changing in the atmosphere. And the reason it's so important is because it's really the nighttime temperatures that make our lives so much more uncomfortable if we don't have access to air conditioning or somewhere cool to sleep at night. There's basically there's a minimum temperature at which your body cannot cool itself through sweating and so forth anymore. And so if that minimum temperature is exceeded, then their bodies just can't cool themselves anymore. So it leads to a lot of health implications. And the reason the nights are warming so much faster than the daytime, and because that's so important, is because we have a lot more moisture in the atmosphere now than we used to. This is because the air is getting warmer. It can hold more moisture, and the oceans are warmer, so they're evaporating more moisture into the air. And so this is really what's leading to the nights warming so fast, because that moisture in the air traps the heat and doesn't allow it to escape to outer space, like on a dry night.
You mentioned the Arctic, and I was reading, and again going, well, this goes to NASA, actually. NASA finding since 1992, Antarctica has lost 3 trillion tons of ice, 40% of that loss in the last 5 years. How important is what's happening in Antarctica on weather and climate?
Well, this is also extremely important because when Antarctica loses ice, which is the same situation as Greenland and glaciers on land. So any ice that's on land, when it melts, it adds directly to the oceans. And, of course, when you add water to the ocean, it's going to rise up. And this is one of the main contributors to sea level rise. We're seeing an acceleration of the contribution to sea level rise from land ice, so especially Greenland and Antarctica. So this is a very big deal.
There's always been this differentiation between weather, which is, of course, what happens every day. It's kind of a short-term event, versus climate, which obviously is weather over a certain pattern of time. Can we make a link now between weather and climate?
We can absolutely make a link between these two, between climate change, I think, is what you really mean.
Right.
And so the change in climate is definitely having impacts on our weather. As we've already talked about, just the increasing global temperatures because of all the extra greenhouse gases in the atmosphere now is making it much more likely to see extreme heat events and also droughts and very persistent conditions, as we've already talked about. And very pertinent to what's going on today, we already talked about also this extra water vapor in the atmosphere, the warmer oceans and the warmer air. These are all fuel for tropical storms. And we're seeing Florence, a very, very strong hurricane, bearing down on the Carolinas, and there's no doubt that it is being increased in its intensity and also the amount of rainfall that it's predicted to leave behind on the states that it hits. And also we're seeing this contribution of sea level rise making its coastal impacts even more intense. So these connections to climate change are extremely clear. Less clear are what we also talked about briefly already, and that is the effect on the jet stream. Mm-hmm. So what we think is happening in connection with climate change is, as the Arctic is warming so fast, it's making these jet stream patterns of large north-south swings happen more often, leading to these more persistent weather conditions that we've been observing, not just this summer, but also in the winters. So we're seeing a real shift in the weather patterns that we're seeing in all different locations, especially in the Northern Hemisphere, that we believe are connected to climate change. And this is an area of very active research right now.
Is there concern with Florence that not only she becomes a stronger storm, but with more rain, more winds, but also that then she gets stuck and then doesn't leave?
Yes. So that the aspect of the getting stuck part, which may remind people of what happened with Hurricane Harvey last year, which was the same situation where the storm came ashore and just got stuck and ended up dumping, you know, many, many, many inches of rain in one place. Well, this is probably what's going to happen with Florence. And we do think that, as I said, these changes to the jet stream that tend to favor persistent weather conditions are exactly the kind of thing that are affecting Harvey and now Florence. So we do expect to see these somewhat unusual paths of hurricanes moving westward, like Florence is doing, like Sandy did, and also this tendency for storms to get stuck in one place.
Final question, about a minute here. How, though, do weather extremes or climate change lead to both droughts and floods?
Right. So those, we have to go back to the jet stream again, and those north-south swings that the jet stream tends to take, those waves in the jet stream are what create the weather patterns that we see on a typical TV weather map with high pressures and low pressures. And so if we have a tendency for these waves to get stuck in one place, then you will be experiencing, with whether you have a high pressure or a low pressure in your area, it could be a very prolonged dry period, or it could be a very prolonged wet period. Hmm. It just depends on where these waves in the jet stream are located relative to you.
We can't take Hank's call because we have to say goodbye to you, but he wonders whether some of the cleaner fuels and either some of the stricter environmental regulations have made a difference, or does it just doesn't work that quickly? Jennifer, we're almost out of time here. Sorry about that.
Oh, I can say real quickly, yes, it's making a difference, but it's a small difference for now, and we have many, many other things that we all need to do to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Jennifer Francis, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
Absolutely. Research professor at Rutgers University's Department of Marine and Coastal Science. We've got Juliet Eilperin from The Washington Post waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoena, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump made no bones about his plans to undo many of the Obama administration's environmental policies. He campaigned on that promise, and his first EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, worked to make it happen. He, as you know, later resigned under a cloud of ethical scandals for his profligate behavior. The agency is now being run by Pruitt's deputy, Andrew Wheeler, a former coal lobbyist who has continued the dismantling of environmental regulations and has faced some court challenges. We asked Juliet Eilperin, who is National Senior Affairs Correspondent for The Washington Post, to join us. Juliet, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
And to our listeners, lines open once again, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Juliet, EPA under Wheeler versus EPA under Pruitt minus the scandals, how different is it?
It's very similar in a number of ways when you talk about policy. What we've certainly seen is that Andrew Wheeler, who had been a longtime congressional Hill staffer for Republicans and lobbyist before joining the agency last year, joining the agency earlier this year, has been pursuing a number of the same policies in terms of relaxing Obama-era curbs on greenhouse gas emissions, whether you're talking about for power plants or it's on the cusp of doing that from leaks that come from oil and gas wells. And so what we're seeing is he really is just as committed to deregulation and other aspects of President Trump's agenda, but has certainly been more conciliatory towards, for example, staffers, has shown them more respect, allowed them slightly more input into decision making, even if he's ending up pursuing the same kind of policies as his predecessor.
My understanding at the EPA is that there have been a number of people, maybe even a lot of people, that have left the agency. Are we witnessing a brain drain of sorts?
Yes. I wrote a story with a couple of colleagues, Brady Dennis and Andrew Tran, which ran over the weekend, where through Freedom of Information Act requests, we were able to document both the total drop in employees, which has been a little over 8% during the first 18 months of the Trump administration, and also the fact that we looked at who is leaving, and what you're seeing without question is a massive exodus of scientists, engineers, and environmental protection specialists, according to EPA records. And there's been a concerted effort across the government for for cutbacks and a freeze on hiring. But what we're seeing at EPA is through the buyouts and retirement packages that they've been offering, it's really many of the senior people who are leaving, and they're not really hiring younger experts and researchers to take their place.
Where are those people going? Who's going to hire someone from the EPA?
Well, actually, it depends what you're talking about. Some of the junior level folks who, for example, were doing postdocs, at research centers, they're quite, marketable. So some of them have gone to, academia or to environmental consulting firms. So in many ways, they have opportunities. There's also, say, a vehicle emissions lab of EPA that's in Ann Arbor, and what we've seen there is, again, some of the junior folks have gone to work for industry. In terms of these senior folks, these people who had put in more than 30 years in the agency, they're really taking retirement packages, and for the most part, they might be doing some consultancy, but they're not actually, looking for another full-time job because they worked for the federal government for so long.
I do want to talk about the Clean Power Plan, but first a tweet from Margo, who says, the recent push to roll back methane rules is truly stupid. While methane doesn't last as long in the atmosphere as CO2, it does have a more extreme impact on temperature increases. And the administration does want to essentially weaken an Obama-era requirement that companies monitor repair methane leaks. I have to say, Juliet, I'm quoting from the New York Times there. But what's behind all this?
Well, again, this is a rule that was, again, part of the overarching goal of the Obama administration to crack down on greenhouse gas emissions linked to climate change, as you were just discussing earlier on the show. And, certainly there's no question that methane is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas. While it's not released in the same amounts across the globe as carbon dioxide, it is more powerful as a force for climate change. And so this is something that the oil and gas industry didn't like. They wanted more discretion in terms of how they were responsible for the flaring or burning of methane from drilling operations, and argued that there are plenty of state policies in place. And so what we certainly expect, it has not been published, but according to our discussions as well with federal officials, EPA, either today or tomorrow, will be releasing a rollback of that rule, and the Interior Department has a related rule on the same topic that will come out at some point this month.
This was another big piece of news over the summer having to do with the Clean Power Plan. This, again, an Obama administration era regulation. Also connected, and I'll just put this out here, and Juliet, you can correct me if I have it wrong, but back in 2007, the Supreme Court ruled that greenhouse gases were a threat to public health. Therefore, they must be regulated as part of the Clean Air Act. And EPA, I guess, essentially had the authority to oversee this. The Trump administration wants to undo this, but it seems that they are up against some rules, some court rulings. Where does this stand, and did I get that right?
You did. Your description is accurate. And great. So what's happening is that they, as you mentioned, it's really basically it's settled law that carbon dioxide can be regulated under the Clean Air Act and is it technically a pollutant. But how you do that, you know, depends on your policy perspective. And so, for example, under the Obama administration, they issued a rule called the Clean, they called it the Clean Power Plan, and it has actually been stayed through litigation. Again, you had kind of Republican attorneys general as well as industry challenging the way EPA wanted to limit greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. They took a very kind of sweeping view of this and argued that it's not just a question of what pollution controls you put on power plants at the source, but you could meet specific reduction targets by encouraging energy efficiency, by deploying wind and solar and other renewables. And essentially their goal with their rule was to speed the retirement of existing coal plants. They established a standard that was strict enough that it would phase out essentially all the, you know, the existing power coal-fired plants in the U.S. So just a few weeks ago, in August, the EPA, under President Trump, issued what they call the Affordable Clean Energy Rule. Everyone loves to put clean in their names.
Of course.
And their argument was, it is not our job to force coal plants to retire. We will come up with a rule that will allow these coal-fired plants to continue as long as, you know, we can, you know, we kind of are essentially locking in what the overall market forces are doing anyway. And as a result, you have they could become more efficient in how they burn coal, but they would continue to do it. And so that is what is currently now subject to public comment and will, of course, also be subject to an intense court fight going forward.
Well, I was going to say, and you wrote about several of these efforts to undo Obama-era rules and regulations ending up in court. I think you began by saying it's a little harder to unravel what the Obama administration did than the Trump administration thought would happen. Are the courts then this line of defense, I guess, against the Trump administration?
Yes, certainly that's how a number of environmental groups and Democratic attorneys general view them at this point. And they have reason for, you know, at least some measured optimism because, frankly, some of these laws that were passed in the 1970s are quite protective of public health and, frankly, are more liberal than, for example, what would likely pass Congress now. And so given kind of some of the stringent requirements of these laws, and as well as just some longstanding rules about how the process one goes through to flip a rule that's existing, an existing regulation, they have made a lot of progress in the early stages in challenging some of these regulatory rollbacks. Now, the jury is still out. Sorry to, you know, didn't
sure.
mean to
okay.
give that pun, but basically we are certainly waiting to see, because there are several steps in this process, whether they will be able to block all of these rules. But, for example, when the Affordable Clean Energy Rule just came out a couple of weeks ago, but frankly, both conservative and liberal lawyers noted that there's, for example, part of it which involves a relaxing a, you know, kind of traditional air pollution requirement that immediately would be vulnerable to legal challenge. And so there's no question that it's not as simple as simply issuing a changed policy and it taking effect.
That's Juliet Alperin, and she's senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. And we've been talking about the Environmental Protection Agency and some of the efforts of the Trump administration to undo some of those Obama administration era rules and regulations. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I wonder, though, Juliet, whether the Trump administration is up against states like California, which have a lot of sway over things like gas mileage, and because there's so many people there, I guess, and because they seem to be rather forward-thinking on a number of these issues. But are we going to see, or are we even seeing, it's the federal government against some of these states when it comes to environmental regulations?
Yes, we are seeing a very organized effort by more liberal states to challenge, both in court and in terms of the policies that they're pursuing, some of what Trump is doing and his deputies are doing here in Washington. And so they really are kind of stole a page from the Republican playbook, but which of course had an effort to challenge Obama. And in fact, they're being more aggressive than Republicans were. And so we're seeing this, you know, both play out in some of these court challenges and in terms of the policies that they're adopting. California, the outgoing governor, Jerry Brown, just signed legislation yesterday that, you know, mandates that California will go fully renewable in, you know, a matter of decades. And so I think what we're seeing is that they're using every lever they can, but particularly the courts. And California is really uniquely powerful in this regard, both because there's some longstanding provisions that allow them, for example, to pursue policies aimed at curbing greenhouse gas emissions. And as you mentioned, because of their market influence. But when they push for something, it does have a ripple effect. Because if you're an automaker and you're looking at how you're going to produce vehicles, you might have to consider what it means to, you know, be shut out of such a major market.
I wonder, too, about utilities and even car companies. I know there's a proposal to, I believe, freeze the Obama administration's requirement of something like 35 miles per gallon for 2020. The idea coming from the Trump administration to freeze tailpipe emissions, but whether there is demand coming from consumers for more energy efficient cars, or even coming from utilities or the car industry saying, look, we've already sort of put things into place here to meet these higher standards.
That's a great question, and it really depends on what sector you're talking about. So in terms of vehicles, for example, it is absolutely true that American consumers are not asking for as energy efficient vehicles as was anticipated a few years ago when some of these policies were put in place. For example, it's not as if every American is pushing to get an electric vehicle or a hybrid vehicle. We're still seeing extremely significant demand for cross utility vehicles, maybe not the hugest trucks, but, you know, large kind of mini SUVs. And as a result, that does have an influence on the market. And that's part of why automakers were seeking this flexibility, because they basically were saying they were having a harder time selling the most efficient vehicles. The interesting contrast to that is actually in the utility market, no one's building a new coal-fired power plant.
And
many of these companies are switching to natural gas, which is more efficient, as well as renewables. And so there, we're actually seeing a market transition that in many cases is, for example, more aggressive than what the Trump administration is suggesting.
Let me read a couple of comments. One from James. Instead of someone saying they believe in or don't believe in climate change, we need to change the dialogue for them to state whether they believe in or don't believe in all the scientific evidence that has brought scientists to agree that there is climate change. Also a question. There's tons of money in the Arctic in the form of oil and gas. I wonder if the EPA rollbacks have anything to do with getting at those natural resources. Juliet, is there an answer? Can we answer that question?
That is really a separate question, which has to do with when you're talking about oil and gas exploration in the Arctic, that is something that is really driven by the Interior Department, which is looking at, for example, expanding offshore leasing in, you know, for example, in those areas, and also opening up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is something that has been a battle going back decades, a generation. And there we are seeing a real push, again, by the Trump administration to make those areas available for oil and gas exploration. One of the real questions is whether there's market demand. It's extremely expensive to operate in those environments, even as they are warming somewhat. And so as much as, you know, for example, the Interior Department sometimes, you know, could, you know, have held a lease sale and in one instance in Alaska did not get as much interest as they anticipated, as officials have anticipated, because frankly, the companies know how costly and controversial it is to pursue energy exploration there.
So coal is not in our future, in our future?
Everyone, including, you know, the, for example, utility executives would say that we are heading towards a carbon constrained world and that coal over time will be phased out. The real question is, what's the pace of that phase out? There are plenty of folks who own existing coal plants, and it's much cheaper for them to keep operating them for years now that they've made the investment. And so they are looking to the Trump administration to allow them to do this. But over the long term, is coal going to be the source of our electricity in the United States? No, there are very few people who see that being sustained over many decades.
Well, Juliet Perrin, thank you once again for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And she's senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. We were talking with her about the Trump administration's efforts to undo many of the Obama administration's environmental rules and regulations and policies. We're going to take another short break, and then we'll be talking about some good news on the environmental front. So do stay with us. We'll be talking about the Chesapeake Bay. Looks like it's staging a bit of a comeback. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, we've been talking about the warming planet and threats of climate change and hurricanes and the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle environmental regulations, and now for something completely different. Seagrass is staging a comeback, which indicates the health of the Chesapeake Bay is improving. Pollution from phosphorus and nitrogen had robbed the country's largest estuary of vital nutrients, resulting in the loss of habitat and marine life. So what explains this turnaround? We asked Bill Dennison to join us. He's a professor of marine science and vice president for science applications at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Bill Dennison, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And again, lines open 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Any questions or comments that you might have? Well, let's start with some of this good news. Why is seagrass such an important sign of a returning health to the Chesapeake Bay?
We call seagrasses the coastal canary. They're the coal miners used to take the canary down into the coal mine, and they would keel over when the carbon dioxide got a little too high before, and they were more sensitive than humans. So if the miners saw the canary faint, they would grab that canary in the cage and run out of the mine and then figure the problem out. So seagrasses, like the canary, have a very high sensitivity to underwater light. So they need more light than any other plants in the ocean. And as a result, that when they started to disappear, which really it was in the 1970s in Chesapeake Bay, that prompted the scientists and the resource managers to study the problem, and they established it was overabundance of nutrients, runoff from fertilizer and sewage, and stormwater was causing the decline. Eventually formed the Chesapeake Bay Program, which turned eventually into a nutrient diet, the total maximum daily load. And what we just learned recently is that through analysis of over 30-year data sets of seagrasses as well as water quality, that the water quality improvements due to this nutrient diet are stimulating a resurgence of these underwater grasses.
Well, let me pick up on several things that you said. And you talk about the importance of these grasses and the fact that they need sunlight. And obviously with the pollution, that was diminishing the sunlight, and they paid a kind of price for that. With their return, what returns with them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Marty. The seagrasses form a really important habitat in the bay. So they do several things. One is the leaf canopy serves as a giant baffle that causes the water to slow down and the sediments to settle out. They absorb the nutrients that are in the water. And so the water inside these beds is very clear, and they can promote an expansion of the bed by clarifying their water. So there are these positive feedbacks that they create. Then they also provide a fantastic habitat. The blue crabs, our wonderful iconic blue crabs, like to go into the grass beds to molt when they in that stage where they're fairly exposed. They like to be hidden down at the bottom of the grass bed. So that's an important habitat for molting blue crabs, but also for many small little fish and invertebrates that spend part of their life cycle, kind of a nursery habitat. So these little things are in those grass beds that then grow up and move on out. So it's a really important habitat. And what, you know, we have this great resurgence up in the Susquehanna Flats, up at the top of the bay near Isla de Grace. And the crabbing and the fishing is the best in the bay up near this fantastic resurgent grass bed up there.
Well, let's go back. Is it the 1970s when you began to see the seagrass decline, as you mentioned, based on some pollution, I guess? What are we talking about? Runoff here? Explain what happened, I guess, to destroy so much of the seagrass.
Okay, well, first of all, there was a major event, 1972, Hurricane Agnes, which is the largest recorded Susquehanna flow that we've got over 100-year data record for. It happened early in the summer, late June, so it turned out it was a devastating effect on the bay. A huge amount of freshwater, bolus of freshwater came down, a lot of turbidity, wiped out the grasses throughout the upper bay and even into the mid and impacts on the lower bay. And that was also a sort of a turning point for what had been a very dry decade in the 1960s to a very wet decade in the 70s. So not only was there this major event in 1972, but then the subsequent years were very wet and lots of runoff and not much good. We hadn't really been aware of the problem. The farming practices were not good at protecting the farms from runoff of the topsoil, and we had lots of development that occurred. So there was a way too much overflow of sewage treatment plants, way too much stormwater coming off of the ag fields throughout those 70s, and the grasses really took a beating. And we started seriously looking into the causes. We being the scientific community, I wasn't around at the time, but the generation before me did some important studies to really isolate the problem and identify nutrients as the major cause of that decline.
And we're talking about phosphorus and nitrogen. What's so interesting is that obviously a very serious problem, and of course the Chesapeake Bay as the country's largest estuary, such an important piece of property in the United States here. But you had, what, five or six states, the EPA, essentially, and maybe not perfectly, but certainly working together to try to address this problem. Was this unique, unusual cooperation?
Yeah, well, when the Bay Program was formed in 1983, it was actually at that point just three of the six states. It was Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Maryland, and the federal government that put the Bay Program together. That was quite unique to have that partnership between states, federal government, and you know they really were trailblazing at the time. It's been emulated throughout the world since then. And since that 1983 inception, they've grown and evolved. It's very much a partnership with the six states, and added Pennsylvania, added New York, Delaware, and West Virginia. So the entire watershed of Chesapeake is covered. It included a whole lot of new partners, a lot of non-government NGOs have been engaged, lots of local municipalities. They do a lot of the funding that comes into the Chesapeake Bay Program gets funneled out to a wide diversity of small community groups and to local municipalities and state governments to implement the water quality improvement plans, the WIPs, which are the way that the states are responding to this nutrient diet. They've allocated nutrient reductions to each state, and they come up with plans to achieve those nutrient reductions. And we're about midway through that nutrient diet. It was set up in 2010. It was set to complete in 2025. And so we had the midpoint assessment last year in 2017. And we're on, you know, we're not sort of, so at the halfway mark, we're close to the mark, but a little low, a little undershot just a bit. But at least we've reversed the long-term trajectory of degradation, and now we're starting to see these positive signs of recovery. So it gives us some it heartens our effort to go and continue these nutrient reductions. They are making a difference.
And that's Bill Dennison from the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science talking about some good news involving the Chesapeake Bay. And it looks like the health of the bay is improving based on a number of steps that were taken by a total of six states and also the federal government. 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me just go back to something, and then I'll read some of the comments that we have here. So if the source of the problem back in the 70s and into the 80s was agriculture, as you mentioned, a wastewater treatment, I'm assuming car pollution and construction projects as well. Were there then efforts put or rules and regulations put into place to reduce the impact of runoff from those sources?
Yeah, a couple of really important pieces of legislation that have direct bearing on the success of Chesapeake Bay restoration are the Clean Air Act from 1971 and the Clean Water Act from 1972. These pieces of federal legislation have made a big difference. So the Clean Air Act, what they did is and everybody that drives knows that we have catalytic converters now.
Right.
And those were put on to reduce the amount of NOx, the nitrogen that comes out of the tailpipe and then goes up in the atmosphere and then eventually, it gets caught up in rain and snow and comes back down on the bay and on the watershed. So, as well, in the smokestacks of the power plants, particularly in the Ohio Valley, because the airshed of Chesapeake Bay is a lot bigger than the watershed. So the airshed includes the Ohio Valley and all the power plants on the Ohio River in Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, et cetera, are wafting into the bay watershed and precipitating out. Well, those smokestacks now have scrubbers, and those electrostatic scrubbers that are on the smokestacks also, like the catalytic converters on our cars, reduce the amount of nitrogen going up into the atmosphere. So as a result of the Clean Air Act, we've got cleaner rain, and some of our colleagues, our scientists up at the Appalachian Lab in Western Maryland, have been documenting this improvement of the forest that are intercepting the rain, reducing the nitrogen. Those streams that are coming out of these forests have lower amounts of nitrogen. So ultimately, the bay is getting clean from the sky as much as it is from the other sources. Now, the other big one, the Clean Water Act, was the federal government's push to get sewage treatment upgrades. So now in Chesapeake Bay, we have a fantastic set of sewage treatment facilities. We have the one that services Washington, D.C., Blue Plains, is the largest in the East Coast of the United States, maybe in one of the largest in the world in terms of advanced wastewater treatment. So they're doing primary, secondary, and tertiary treatment. The tertiary, the third level of treatment, that added level, is what removes the nitrogen and phosphorus. And those are making, as a result, the Potomac River downstream of Blue Plains is doing a lot better. Baltimore has a new plant online, that Back River, that's also upgraded to that high standard. And so, one by one, all the smaller plants around Chesapeake Bay are upgrading. There's Hampton Roads down in Virginia has a very advanced sewage treatment facility. So those sewage upgrades have really made a difference, and almost instantaneous. Those are the quickest kind of response we see. Within a couple of years after getting online, we start to see grasses coming back, clams and fish, and so those are great success stories. So the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act did well.
I appreciate the explanation. We've got a couple of minutes. I have a couple more questions for you. The obvious one, and Scott Pruitt, of course, the former EPA administrator, described what you described, this effort by the EPA and also these states addressing the problem of the Chesapeake Bay, that was overreach. He opposed it. There's concern about cutbacks. As you mentioned, it's about halfway through this recovery process. Are you concerned, Bill, in just a couple of words, if you don't mind, are you concerned that some of this success will be undone?
I am concerned. However, so far, Congress has maintained the funding for the Bay program so they can act as a neutral umpire between the states. They can stimulate and catalyze these very effective partnerships. I think the people are starting to see this. Grasses are a little, they're an acquired taste. I love grasses, sea grasses, but not everyone sees and hears them. But when it comes to dolphins, we have we've got a new app that's called Chesapeake Dolphin Watch, and over 1,000 sightings of dolphins in Chesapeake Bay were made this summer. Dolphins are appearing in places we haven't seen them in decades. That's a great sign. Our so-called dead zone, the oxygen, reduced oxygen in the middle of the bay, is shrinking. So we're getting great fish catches and shellfish. So we're starting to see positive, tangible things that everybody can identify with. And my hope is that groundswell of public opinion will help sway the federal government's ability to maintain the funding to support this effort.
And Bill, one of our listeners wants you to give a shout out to the Chesapeake Bay Watershed Foundation. You mentioned a number of organizations involved in this recovery process.
Well, there are a myriad of organizations that are actively doing Chesapeake things: the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, the Alliance for Chesapeake Bay, the Chesapeake Bay Trust, the Chesapeake Bay Commission. There are just a few that I can think of immediately, but there are thousands of people working all around the watershed doing pretty amazing things, using a lot of ingenuity, a lot of innovation to figure out ways to reduce our runoff. We still have to get at the agricultural and stormwater, urban stormwater runoff. So those are the remaining big tasks before us, and we're going to need a lot of innovation and creativity to crack that nut.
Well, Bill Dennison, we always appreciate some good news. Thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor of Marine Science and Vice President for Science Applications at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.